team from the department to all welcome. I guess we start from where we left off yesterday. And, I must say that we have been doing very well, and let's continue at that note. Yes.
Good morning, Chairperson and honourable members. Chair, we have the same team as yesterday, but today we have four chapters remaining to provide responses to the comments that we received. Detailed comments are in the documents that are circulated, so we will give you the highlights as we've been doing over the last few days. Mr. Mangena will take us through chapter 10 and 11. And chapters 12 and 13, Mr. Robertson will continue. I must say they are short chapters, so we hope to be done as soon as possible. But after we are done, Chair, I wonder whether you have any directions for us in terms of how we prepare when we come back, because we have a proposal and how we think we should do it, because you will notice that in our response document we've made a certain recommendations where we think the bill could be amended for improvement and in line with the comments received. We will go back and firstly try and effect that those changes. So when we come back to the committee, we are prepared. But over and above that, we intend to come back to Parliament with a very short document written in simple language. Not.
I think let's just proceed and at the end. We can do that, but it's not our intention to stage manage you. We will listen to your proposals as to why you want to proceed, and members will consider your proposal. If they want to amend, and then they are free to do so. But let's proceed from where we left off yesterday.
Okay, so I'll hand over to Mr. Mangena and he'll discuss it later.
Thank you very much. This morning we're going to start chapter 10, which deals with structures that deal with cyber security. It's in part B, page 1, part B of the package that you have in front of yourselves. And then we're going to start with paragraph 11.1 under general. 11.1.2, Mr. Haink comments that the bill takes an authoritarian approach to cybersecurity. Part B of the Part A and Part B. So in page 1 of Part B, on top it's written chapter 10, structures that deal with the cybersecurity. Did you find it?
Continue.
Other members aware of that? Thank you. Under paragraph 11.1.2, Mr. Haink comments that the bill takes an authoritarian approach to cybersecurity. More specifically, that chapter 11 of the bill must facilitate public-private partnerships, which, despite being addressed in the national cybersecurity policy framework, are absent from the bill. And the department comments by saying that the NCPF deals with public-private partnerships relating to cybersecurity, and it submitted that it's not necessary to provide for this in the bill. The policy further states that the policy further places obligations on the department to acquire necessary capacity to deal with the mandate to implement the policy itself. It further elaborates or illustrates that partnerships, in essence, mean that there must be a consensual basis of cooperation and cohesive basis of legislative obligations that must be adhered to. It's not necessary. In paragraph 11.1.3, Mr. Haink continues to comment that the bill does not take the full status of privacy and protection of personal information into account, as it undoubtedly should. He further comments that the importance of privacy and powers of the information regulators have not been recognized in the bill. And then we responded by saying that the building blocks for cybersecurity were referred to in the previous paragraph 1.25, and the aim of this principle is to ensure the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of computer system. We further respond by saying that the bill deals with general principles of cybersecurity and the protection of personal information provided for in POPIA is not necessary to specifically refer in other laws to aspects that are already comprehensively dealt with in POPIA. The approach which the government has taken is therefore in line with the AU Convention as well as the approach that was taken by most other countries in the world. In page 3, Cell C, Telkom and Vodacom are of the view that there is no clarity as to which organ of the state ultimately holds supreme authority to ensure that these entities all operate and interact seamlessly and that the overall objectives of the bill are achieved. And we respond by saying that the CRC, which is going to be the main structure that will be playing a role in this regard, consists of heads of representative departments as is defined in clause 53, subsection 8. This body is chaired by SSA, State Security Agency, and the cabinet member responsible for state security is accountable to Parliament regarding the functioning of the CRC. What needs to be stressed is that the ministers of these departments are accountable to Parliament regarding the implementation of those initiatives. In paragraph 11.1.5, Professor von Solms of the University of Johannesburg is of the view that the bill aims to establish at least 3 CSERs, namely the 24/7 Center, the Government CSER, and the Cyber Hub. And these structures require extensive experience and technical expertise required to main asset. And in short, to unbundle the acronym CSER, it stands for the Computer Security Incident Response Team. So for short, we call it CSER. And he further comments that there is massive skill shortage in South Africa, and he's of the view as a result that the structures should be merged into a single structure and all available skills which would have been deployed in 3 structures should be consolidated. Well, we know these comments, and the reason for not having one structure is to cater for different constitutional mandate of the department. We further respond by saying that a one-size-fits-all approach cannot be used to address these different objectives. In clause 54, the clause imposes obligations on different departments to obtain required capacity to come to terms with their obligations imposed to them in terms of the bill. And the CFC has a general obligation to ensure the implementation of the policy as well as the bill. So in page 5, under paragraph 11.1.6, SEBRIC commented that the establishment of the proposed structures in the public-private sector may focus the attention on skills development, which we agree to. And now we move down to clause 53 under paragraph 11.2, where media monitoring comments as follows, that a concern is raised regarding cabinet member responsible for state security is responsible for oversight of cyber response committee. As pointed out earlier on, the CRC consists of various departments that have different constitutional mandates. And so the Director General is the chairperson responsible to ensure that the CRC fulfills its functions and is as assigned to it in terms of the bill, and it's not, it is submitted that the CRC cannot therefore be regarded as being under control of SSA. And media monitoring further comment that the oversight function should be allocated to the minister, to the administration, under the administration of justice and constitutional development, I mean, Director General of Justice and Constitutional Development. And we still are of the view that the chairpersonship of the Director General of SSA should not be seen as a means of ensuring that the CRC answers only to him, because all the departments participate in an equal, on an equal basis. In page 6, paragraph 11.2.2, media monitoring continues to comment on the composition of the CRC, which they criticize due to the fact that persons outside government are not represented on the CRC, and it suggested that the CRC be structured similar to the Judicial Services Commission. Well, we respond by saying that the role of the NCPF as identified ensures that appropriate consultation between the JCPS Labor Department and the private sector and civil society regarding cybersecurity matters do take place. The policy promotes coordination and consultation between the JCPS cluster department, the private sector, and the civil society regarding cybersecurity matters. So to ensure interaction and consultation and to enhance interaction and consultations and promote a coordinating role regarding engagements with the private sector and civil society, the cybersecurity hub will, according to the policy, have the responsibility to coordinate general security in consultation with the cyber response committee. Western Cape comments further in page 7 that the provision should be made for provincial representatives on the Cyber Response Committee. And we respond by saying that telecommunication does not fall within the ambit of Schedule 4 or 5 of the Constitution that deals with functional areas of concurrent national and provincial legislative competence and exclusive provincial legislative competence, respectively. So the aim of CRC is to deal with matters relating to ICTs that falls within the domain exclusive national legislative competence. In page 8, the Minister of Finance commented that the Cyber Response Committee includes Treasury, National Treasury, the South African Reserve Bank, and the South African Reserve Revenue Services. And although any other department or public entity may be requested to assist the CRC, it is submitted that the word public entity be replaced with any other organ of the state. And we are in agreement, and what follows thereafter is a proposed amendment which captures what the Minister of Finance is proposing. Further down in paragraph 11.2.5, TBCSA, comments that the private sector in the form of CEPRIC should be included since they have information, expertise, and technology with other institutions, which other institutions may not have. And we commented in paragraph 11.2 above that massive broad consultation usually will take place before any other thing can be undertaken. And we did make mention of the fact that the policy enjoins us to consult extensively and enjoins us to promote coordination and consultation with cluster departments, the private sector, civil society regarding cybersecurity. So their fears are effectively addressed. And further down in 11.2.6, the South African Human Rights Commission are of the view that Chapter 9 institutions, experts in the field of cybersecurity, civil society, should also be included in the decision-making structure. And our response is similar to what we have just I've just said in the comment under 11.2.5. Then in page 9, the information regulator was of the view that they need to be included in the CRC. And over the past days, we did make mention of the fact that it's crucial that the information regulator not participate in such structures and focus their its energy on POPIA, because the participation of the information regulator in such initiatives may create an adverse perception regarding the independence of the information regulator. So it's best for the information regulator to stay outside of this realm. Under paragraph 11.2.8, freedom of religion, comments that the CRC reports to the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence that is not accessible to the public, and thus the public can further not participate in the proceedings of the CRC that has extensive powers to regulate the internet. And then we respond by saying that not all reports that are submitted to the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence are closed documents. Various reports of the designated RICA. Judge were made available in the spirit of transparency and accountability.
Honorable members, I think if you want to interject, just indicate, because as we said, these matters are complex. The team will understand if we have to interject, so that we don't pile up misunderstandings until the end. Christine, do you want to say something?
Just around the reporting obligations of the Minister of State Security, and then also it would apply to all of the other different cabinet members involved, is that, you know, with State Security and Defence, they report, they submit their annual reports to the Joint Standing Committees of either Intelligence or Defence. But would it not be better if those reports get tabled at with Parliament, and then obviously Parliament would refer them to the relevant committee?
Okay. As long as we avoid debating, I think if we just indicate if there's something that is not clear, so that we also don't disturb their flow of thought. Honorable Majer. Mr. Magena, proceed.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Now we're still in page 9, clause 55, under paragraph 11.3, which deals with the establishment of nodal points and private sector computer security incident response teams. CELSI, Telkom, and Vodacom are of the view that the costs involved in the establishment of nodal points and the obligations of the nodal point are unclear, and it's proposed that there should be a cost and impact assessment before implementation of the clause. And we are of the view that nodal points are essential for cybersecure South Africa, and nodal points do not imply that service providers must establish CSERs to deal with cyber threats. Nodal points imply that a sector, for instance, the mobile providers, must bring into operation a contact point for all mobile cellular sector to impart information of cyber threats, which must be made known to other sector participants or the cyber hub. So in many sectors, there is already information sharing of cyber threat and technical solutions. So it's submitted that cost implications would be minimal. Credit Bureau Association is of the view that the bill places onerous and costly obligations on the private sector to establish CSERF. And we are of the view that an obligation to establish nodal points which have a limited cost implication, as pointed out earlier, does not specifically provide that they must establish CSERF. They already have the technology. Theirs is just to aggregate and ensure that there is equal information sharing amongst the members of that particular sector. So the cost will be minimal under this concern. So Cedric down there is of the view that regulations which may be issued to regulate CSERF should not be over-prescriptive. The proposed structures with information sharing capabilities are necessary in order to enhance cybersecurity. And we respond by saying that there are no obligations that are imposed on sectors to establish CSERF. We only say that clause 55(6) of the bill provides that the cabinet member responsible for communications may recognize a CSERF that has been established for that particular sector. So in order to facilitate effectiveness of a CSERF and possible full participation of other entities in that sector, regulations may be made to regulate the effectiveness of that particular CSERF. So in page 11, under paragraph 11.4, we deal with clause 6, which deals with information sharing. Cell C, Telkom, and Vodacom submitted their comment in that they say consultation process with all interested parties must take place in respect of the regulations that will be issued to regulate information sharing. They further state that exchange of information should only take place in circles of trust where it can be verified that the information will be protected. And we responded by saying that the full consultative process will take place on the regulations. The exchange of information will, as a matter of fact, be kept confidential, and appropriate confidentiality provisions will be included in those regulations. Under 11.4.2, the information regulator is of the view that regulations could possibly impact on the mandate of the information regulator, and the clause should be amended to specifically include the information regulator. We have on numerous occasions indicated our position with regards to the participation of the information regulator under this bill, and we're not going to repeat that response. Safe to state that the information regulator should be left to deal only with POPI and issues relating with that particular legislation only. And under paragraph 11.4.3, the South African Human Rights Commission is noting that the fact that personal and other information may be shared, appropriate safeguards should be put in place. The information regulator and other entities should also have a say in this aspect. And we respond by saying that information sharing is an essential building block in cybersecurity. Information sharing to deal with cyber threat is of utmost importance. We don't have terms to actually, define how important that aspect is. Safe to say that information sharing ensures that other entities are timely warned of a threat and to enable them to mitigate that threat. So that's what is required when we want to ensure that we have a cyber secure cyberspace. Among other things that can be done to ensure to allay their fears is that the regulation, among others, could address topics such as restriction of information that can be distributed, the purpose for which it can be used, confidentiality clauses, quality and integrity of the data that is distributed, and transparency, for example. And of course, the drafting of regulations will entail a process of consultation in order to obtain that the views of various persons and entities are heard. So in page 12, Cedric is of the view that information sharing is absolutely essential for cybersecurity. So the sharing between various structures in government and private sector is supported. And we noted their comment and further added that the Cyber Hub actually performed this essential role in the sense that it ensures that information is shared with different sectors to ensure that the safety of the citizens and the Republic is enhanced. This information may be used to warn citizens of cyber threats, measures that can be implemented to guard against such threats. In page 13, paragraph 11.4.5, freedom of religion is of the view that in terms of clause 56, regulations in terms of clause 56 may be used to withhold information from the public and civil society. And we don't agree with that view in the sense that the primary aim of these regulations is to restrict the information that may be shared in order to protect the right to privacy. So that brings us to the end of chapter 10. And we're going to go to chapter 11. Unless if there are questions that can be...
I don't understand. Information which may be shared in order to what?
We say the primary aim of this regulation is to restrict information that may be shared in order to protect the right of privacy.
Can you just explain what that sentence means? It's just the English that I don't understand.
Good evening, Mr. Chairperson. The complaint by freedom of religion is that the information that is shared may be used to withhold certain information from the public. And we do explain first that information sharing is necessary, but on the other hand, in order to share information, the right to privacy of the individual whose information has been shared need to be protected. In general, if you look at information sharing worldwide, the information that is sent from one structure to another is usually scrubbed from all personal information, so that the other structures are only in essence informed of the cyber threat. And that information cannot be identified to a specific person. So in that regard, it's our submission that the regulations aims to protect the privacy of the persons whose information has been divulged to the other structures to take note of cyber threats.
Okay. I hope this sharing of information is qualified also harmful, that the information must not be harmful. Does that come clear somewhere? Because there's some information that is shared that is harmful. Does in the body of this whole thing a qualification to that effect? Does it exist?
It relates to clause 56. There's no specific stipulation that the information that is shared may not be harmful. But obviously, we must look at the POPIA that is actually regulating information sharing through the 8 principles. Amongst others, transparency, consent of the data subject, etc. In essence, if the regulations is to be made, it must comply with POPIA to ensure that everything is protected and is done in accordance with the POPIA.
Okay. Thank you.
Proceed. Thank you very much. Now, we're still in page 13, and we're starting with chapter 11, which deals with critical information infrastructure protection. Under paragraph 12.1, under general, the CELSI, Telcom, and Vodacom commented that standards for protection of critical information infrastructures should be aligned with international best practices, and we are in agreement with regards to that. And the Banking Association of South Africa is of the view that reference is made to Section 76, Subsection 1, Paragraph D and E of the Financial Sector Regulation Act relating to cooperation and collaboration. And they recommend that BASA, they recommend that the business, the Banking Association of South Africa, that financial sector regulators and the South African Reserve Bank should take the provisions of Clause 57 and 58 in this bill into account when applying Section 76 of the FSRA in order to ensure consistency. Furthermore, there should be consistency between the standards to be issued in terms of Section 108, Paragraph 1 of FSRA and Clauses 57 and 58. And we respond by saying that the bill provides for extensive consultation process in the declaration of information, critical information infrastructure where a financial institution is involved. And these measures will ensure that Section 76 and 108 of the FSRA and the provisions of this chapter of the bill are aligned. Zulfikar comment, or in fact poses a question as follows. Does the bill adequately deal with protection of biometric servers and databases and critical information structures? And then we respond by saying that if this form of data is stored within an information infrastructure, that will fall within the ambit of Clause 57, Subsection 2 of the bill. That demarcates the factors that need to be taken into account to declare such information infrastructure a critical information infrastructure. And therefore, this category of data will then be protected. So, going to page 15, Mr. Zulfikar continues to pose another question by saying, how does this bill deal with oversight by state security agency in the implementation of information security standards by the private sector to ensure the protection of biometric information in critical information infrastructures? And we responded by saying that the information security standards that are required to be implemented are regulated by the directive that a cabinet member responsible for state security must issue in terms of Clause 57, Sub 4 of the bill. In Clause 58 of the bill, Clause 58 of the bill ensures oversight in that critical information infrastructures must be audited to ensure compliance with the standards that are imposed on them by means of Section 57, Subsection 4 of the directive. So, in paragraph 12.1.4, STRAAT straight, a comment is raised that certain information infrastructures that may be declared critical information infrastructures are, in terms of other legislation, subject to equivalent or higher information maintenance standards than those required by Chapter 11 of the Bill. And we are of the view that consultation requirement will ensure that alignment of measures to be implemented in respect of protection of critical information take place. And page 16, Credit Bureau Association is of the view that the Credit Bureau Association has a concern that its members may be declared critical information infrastructure in terms of Clause 57 of the bill. And they propose that credit bureaus be exempted from this bill. And we are of the view that it is only under the following circumstances that an information infrastructure may be declared a critical information infrastructure. For example, if there is going to be a substantial prejudice and security, defense, law enforcement, and international relations of the Republic, if there is going to be substantial prejudice to the health or safety of the public, if there is going to be a major interference with or disruption of an essential service, if there's going to be a major economic loss, if there's going to be a destabilization of the economy of the Republic, or there is going to be a major public emergency situation. So under those circumstances, then any structure can be declared as a critical information infrastructure. So, and we go further and say in page 17 that an infrastructure needs to comply with other legislation that does not entitle that infrastructure from exemption. So their request, in a nutshell, is not approved in this regard. In page 17, paragraph 12.1.6, ODAC is of the view that this chapter should be considered as a national key point act for electronic communication systems. The National Key Points Act is a controversial law that is currently being revised. It's pointed out that the chapter will also apply to government in the national, provincial, and local spheres, and it is argued that the minimum information security standard should be adequate to deal with aspects provided for in this chapter. And we respond to that by saying that it is correct that the bill is similar to National Key Points Act. However, we further elaborate and say that the National Key Points Act and the Critical Information Structure Bill deal with physical structures, while Chapter 11 of the bill deals with information infrastructures and data. The objective of the means are to protect classified information in the national interest in both the private and the public spheres. The MISS does not deal with protection of data against vulnerabilities. So the management of cyber security incidents, data contingency and recovery measures that need to be implemented, and physical or technical security measures that are needed to protect information infrastructures, which are dealt with in Chapter 11. The MISS is therefore inadequate to deal with this aspect, and therefore the implementation of measures, of course, may have cost implications, which are, in terms of the bill, placed on the owners of such information infrastructures. Under 12.1.8, SEBREC is of the view that the bill places the initiative to protect critical information infrastructure under government control only, and it submitted that the public and private sector should work together in this regard, and we are in agreement with that position. And then the information regulator is of the view that there are concerns about the identification and declaration of critical information infrastructures and the power of the DG State Security to inspect these structures. And those concerns are noted, so we respond. But it must, however, be pointed out that the grounds on which an information infrastructure can be declared a critical information infrastructure, are limited when you take into account what Clause 57.2 says. So the declaration of information infrastructure is not the sole discretion of a cabinet member responsible for state security. It must take place under consultative framework that involves the CRC, which is composed of various heads of the departments with different mandates. So in page 20, we then deal with the clause 57 under paragraph 12.2, which deals with the protection of information infrastructure. IM consultancy requires us to give a clear definition of critical information infrastructure. And it is submitted that Clause 57 sufficiently identifies a critical information infrastructure in relation to the results that the damage or the disruption may have for the Republic and the government. They further go ahead and say the power of the Minister of State Security to declare any information infrastructure critical information infrastructure is too broad and should be narrowed down. And we did respond to this position in the previous paragraphs, and we're not going to repeat it here to say that there is a multi-departmental participation in such processes and broad consultative approach in as far as dealing with matters relating to the declaration of such entities or the composing of regulations and so forth, which are going to be used to govern these structures. And so there's no way that a single minister or a single official from the ministry can take or dictate to the entire sphere when it relates to the operations of how this declaration is going to take place. So in page 21, IM consultancy is of the view that the chapter needs to provide for critical information infrastructure just under control of the state, since the state can, as a matter of course, implement the required protection measures. We respond by saying that there currently is no prescript that regulates the protection of critical information infrastructure that is in the control of the state. This provides for an opportunity to put in place universal prescripts that will regulate this aspect in both the private and the public domain. They further elaborate and say that Section 52(4) provides that the Minister of State Security must issue directives to regulate the minimum standards, which is a departure from an earlier version of the bill where regulations were required. And when regulations are made, there must be consultation. And again, it's a repetition of the other concerns that were raised earlier, wherein we say that there is, when this process of coming up with regulation is decided upon, public consultation process usually needs to happen so that you can get a buy-in from as many stakeholders as is possible. So under page 22, IM consultancy continues that the minister is not best placed to decide on the minimum standards as contemplated in section 52(4), paragraph A to G, especially if the minister does not consult the industry stakeholders. And we respond by saying that clause 57(5) specifically provides for comprehensive consultative process. So this is the same thing again, where we stress that consultative process, a broad consultative process, is the hallmark of how these things should be addressed going forward to allay such anxieties. They further comment by saying that the directives give the minister the power to prescribe the implementation of measures in order to establish a backdoor into data held by critical information infrastructure. So we're saying that the powers of the minister to determine what measures must be implemented in terms of the directive is limited to aspects contemplated in clause 57(4) A to G and the general ambit of the chapter. And if there's any other thing that a stakeholder may be concerned about, RICA can be used to prosecute any person who accesses data without judicial authority. IM consultancy further comments that security measures under clause 54(4)(e), security measures are continuously changing. to prescribe minimum security measures is flawed and does not take into account how different sectors function. So we respond by saying that the reason why Clause 57 makes provision for the issuing of directives and not to formalize this process through legislation or subordinate legislation is to allow flexibility in the matter. Directives can be changed more rapidly than legislation. This is necessary due to the fact that security measures change as a result of the fast development of ICTs and cyber threats and measures that are developed to address such threats. IM Consultancy further raises the issue that security measures should be left to the infrastructure to decide or should be determined by the specific industry or sector to which the infrastructure belongs. And then we respond by saying that the nature and extent of the directive is subject to a consultation process. And the ambit of Section 19 of WAPIA is restricted to personal information that does not include information such as trade secrets, information about scientific research, plans of our weapon systems, specifications and programs of our computerized weapons, for etc. So in page 24, IM Consultancy raises... Okay.
Can I just request that when members want to interject, speak into the mic.
I'm still speaking.
I mean that I'm not always looking at you. I'm writing. So I may not see you if you want to interject. So just speak into the mic so that I'm able to know that you want to interject.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention.
Thank you.
Where was I? Okay. Now we come into page 24 under paragraph 12.2.7, IM Consultancy. They are of the view that, in fact, they raise the following criticism that is against the dispute resolution clause. They feel that the arbiter who is appointed at the request of the Minister of State Security and Infrastructure merely has to agree thereto. So it's recommended that the arbiter should rather be an independent person to whom both parties agree to. And we are of the view that the word to be agreed on means that there should be or there must be consensus on the body that will conduct the arbitration and the process to be followed. So the infrastructure may, in other ways, request that person X should be appointed, and both parties therefore have to agree on the person that must be appointed as an arbiter. So in page 25, under paragraph 12.2.8, IM Consultancy is of the view that the Minister of State Security must take required steps and recover costs from the person. It is unclear why the costs go directly to the minister and not a fine as was previously proposed. And then we respond by saying that the minister will incur the cost of implementing steps which the person failed to implement. In other words, funds that were allocated to the budget of the SSA will be used to pay for such costs, and the minister have the powers to recover such costs. They further comment that if the state wants to secure a critical information infrastructure in private hands, the state must contribute to such costs, since these measures may have financial implications for information infrastructures. So we respond by saying that businesses flourish under the protection of the state and from contributions of the citizens, which make their activities profitable, and they therefore have a social obligation to ensure that in the interest of society, their services are protected. And in page 26, paragraph 12.2.9, media monitoring is of the view that the broad definition of critical information infrastructure contemplated in clause 57 to read with the definition of information infrastructure in clause 57.12d is criticized. It is submitted that the critical information infrastructure is sufficiently identified in relation to the consequences that may result if the infrastructure is interfered with or is damaged. They further comment by saying that information infrastructures belonging to the media, civil society organizations and non-governmental organizations, journalists and human rights defenders may be declared information infrastructures in terms of clause 57. And in the absence of a clear legislative guidance on the content of the directive, that the minister may issue to the owners of those structures in terms of the of sections 57.4, particularly the classification of data health, this provision may violate information rights, particularly the rights to freedom of expression and privacy. And then we respond by saying that the provision that defines what must be considered a critical information infrastructure will ensure that only essential information infrastructures will be declared as such. So there isn't any doubt about what needs to happen in this regard. So they further raise the concern that a more comprehensive definition should be considered, and in our response, we are of the view that the definition of critical information infrastructure is comprehensive enough as it addresses all the eventualities that may arise, Western Cape is of the view that state security must consult with a premier before an information infrastructure that relates to or is incidental to a functional area listed in Schedule 4 or 5 of the Constitution or assigned to the province by legislation is declared a critical information infrastructure. We agree with that position, and later on we came up with a proposed amendment which actually includes what they are proposing. Western Cape further raises a concern that clause 57.11 authorizes the cabinet minister responsible for state security to implement measures which the person in control of the infrastructure fails to implement. Where a province is involved, section 100 of the Constitution.
You defied my request.
I'm taking advantage of your proximity to the chairperson.
Okay.
Can you go back to the one, I think it's 12.2.10 on Western Cape,
okay,
and consultation with the Premier,
okay,
before the state security can consult?
Okay. Under paragraph 12.2.10, the Western Cape is of the view that clause 57.3b provides that the cabinet member responsible for state security must consult with a premier before an information infrastructure that relates to or is incidental to a functional area listed in Schedule 4 or 5 of the Constitution or assigned to the province by legislation is declared a critical information infrastructure. So the emphasis there is on consultation with the premier.
What normally happens in the normal course of duty in relation to other areas of work? That's what we need to look at.
I can respond to that. Currently, Schedule 4 and 5 to the Constitution, amongst others, place certain areas of control under other concurrent jurisdiction of the national department or provincial department, but there's also certain other areas where a province has got exclusive jurisdiction to deal with aspects. In general, what happens if the constitution do assign comprehensive jurisdiction to the province only, it is completely within the province's constitutional empowerment, and the province can do with that what it deems fit. With this concurrent jurisdiction, well, then I think Chapter 3 of the Constitution will be applicable, and if there is a decision that needs to be implemented in terms of Chapter 3 and other legislation that regulates the role of the province as well as national government, needs to be adhered to. But the bottom line is, usually when something is in the exclusive domain of a province, the province must be, can deal with it as it deems fit.
Covered?
Maybe just to make a comment, isn't it, you will consider this moving forward to say that we are now busy with national legislation. We should actually then have to do with the ministers and competencies of ministers in carrying out their duties in the national sphere.
Thank you, Chair, Petrus, to members. I'm sorry to be late, Chair, I was held up in Zimbabwe, but I'm okay now. I need a comment on the same one as Honorable Chage was saying. Is it a necessity that concurrence from the Premier be required on this one? Because let me just explain why I'm saying that. Here we are dealing with the State Security Department, which might have a certain critical operation in that province. Now, what if the Premier says, or the Office of the Premier doesn't give that concurrence? Will it not be frustrating the State Security in operating their job? I just need a clarity because I want to understand it better on this one.
Mr. Chairperson, I think the Constitution is quite clear. If something falls under a provincial mandate, the province is a government on its own. It can do whatever it wants to. We did explain, Mr. McGinn obviously explained, that the aim is mainly to deal with aspects that falls under the national executive, so far as it relates to information infrastructure. The bill do provide that certain infrastructure that belongs to a province can be declared critical information infrastructure. Currently, that clause in the bill provides that a premier must be consulted in the declaration of such information infrastructure if it falls either within Schedule 4 or 5 of the Constitution. They request that in that regard we must amend the bill to ensure that concurrence is obtained. and it may, to an extent, frustrate the protection of critical information infrastructure, but I think the Constitution is quite clear. If something belongs to a province, it's in the provincial domain.
If the Constitution is clear, shouldn't all legislation be read subject to what the Constitution say? Is it necessary to say in the Constitution that in this province we want this clarified? Because all laws must be subject to the Constitution. The Constitution is overriding authority. Should it be necessary to be saying in Northern Cape or in Limpopo we want this?
Jefferson, it's probably not necessary to clarify it. I think the bill is probably currently fine. We just say consultation with the Premier must take place. And you're right, the bill will be interpreted against constitutional backgrounds. We do not specifically need to insert that in the bill, but maybe for clarity purposes, we can consider it.
Honourable Majaki.
Can we ask the team to look at it and just harmonize it with just the general patterns of doing things in relation to compliance to the Constitution of South Africa?
Because I think the honorable members have made their point. Let's proceed.
Thank you very much.
Paragraph 12.2.13 says C. Oh, I beg your pardon, I've jumped ahead. I was supposed to come to 12.2.11, where Western Cape is of the view that clause 5711 authorizes the cabinet member responsible for state security to implement measures which the person in control of a critical information infrastructure fails to implement. Where a province is involved, Section 100 of the Constitution will be applicable, which deals with national intervention in provincial administration where a province does not fulfill an executive obligation. And it is proposed that the clause should be amended to specifically include reference to Section 100 of the Constitution. So we agree with their concerns in the sense that we even came up with a proposed amendment to clause 5711, which appears there. And in that proposed amendment we say the cabinet member responsible for state security must, when provincial government cannot or does not take steps specified in the notice within the period specified therein, intervene by taking any appropriate steps in accordance with Section 100 of the Constitution to ensure fulfillment of that obligation. So this is the proposed amendment that we thought we should come up with to respond to their concern. Page 28, under paragraph 12.2.12, Cell C, Telkom and Vodacom are of the view that it may be prudent to look at extending the definition to also specifically refer to critical information infrastructure, which includes any critical databases and data housed thereon. Furthermore, the definition must also not lose sight of the processes used to control, enable, and protect the data contained in such critical databases. And our response is that it is admitted that critical information infrastructure that is to be declared as such is defined in clause 5712D, and it means that any data, computer, program, data, storage medium, computer system, or any part thereof, or any building, structure, facility, system, or equipment associated therewith, or part or portion thereof, incidental thereto, which will include database and data house thereon. So, in 12.2.13, Cell C, Telkom further comment that the regulations dealing with dispute resolution should deal with the length of arbitration process. So we respond by saying that the suspension of a declaration as contemplated in clause 57.2 as well as the directive as contemplated in clause 57.4 is by implication not of force and effect if it is disputed. So I'll jump over to page 30. 12.2.14, wherein Cell C, Telkom and Vodacom further comment that the issuing of a direction will have cost implications for an electric communication service provider. We responded to this concern earlier on to say that this is a necessary move that needs to happen, and of course the government is not saying that they must build CSATs from scratch, but they must just organize themselves into nodal points which will be used to relay information, share information, to thwart any threats that may be imminent or that may actually affect the Republic in the long term. In paragraph 4, they further under paragraph B, 12.2.14, paragraph B, they further say that it must further be kept in mind that any electronic communication service providers, not that many electronic service providers do not own the physical network which is used to render a service. And we respond to that by saying that it is foreseen that in some instances there are shared services and directives may impose security measures on both the network provider as well as the service provider. So MTN in 12.2.15 is of the view that standards for protecting critical information infrastructures should be aligned with global standards such as National Institute of Standards and Technology Cybersecurity Framework. And we respond to that by saying that international standards would, to a large extent, dictate what measures must be implemented by service providers. So it is submitted that most service providers that fall within the category of critical information infrastructures already have implemented some of these measures. So there's no need to go and hammer it all over again. Paragraph 12.2 and 2.16, MTN is of the view that the extensive consultation process provided for in the bill relating to the declaration of critical information infrastructure is supported. However, the following concerns are raised. And the first concern is that the ECTA defines electronic communications infrastructure as electronic communications product or system used to transmit or store critical electronic communications. And then we respond to that concern by stating that the bill aims to do away with provisions in the Electronic Communications Transaction Act that deal with critical information infrastructure protection. And the bill repeals Chapter 9 of the ECTA and all those definitions that are there. For example, the definition of critical data, critical databases, critical database administrator. So the second concern that they have is that the bill seems to aim to regulate critical databases by way of directives. And our response to that is that they need to align the protection measures with international standards has been discussed above, and therefore of course when that happens then again the consultative process needs to be undertaken so as to cover every aspect that deal with how these infrastructures or databases are going to be regulated. And further on we respond to that by saying that the aspect of privacy of the customer information has already been addressed, and it is submitted that the directives cannot infringe on any other obligation that exists in the statute book that compels a person or entity to protect the privacy of information. And the direct, I mean, the first concern that they're having is that the guidelines that are to be issued in terms of clause 57 sub 7 should cover the whole arbitration process. And then we respond to that concern by saying that the regulation that must be issued in terms of that clause are restricted to the form and manner in which a dispute must be lodged and matters necessary or incidental thereto, the process for the settlement of disputes. In page 33, the Banking Association of South Africa is of the view that under section 57.4b, the storing and archiving of data per directive should be aligned to other laws relating to the same aspect. And then we respond by stating that provisions that relate to archiving and storage of data will, as a matter of course, be taken into account in issuing of directives in question. The Banking Association of South Africa further make a comment that a financial sector regulator is not referred to in clause, sub-clause 57A. It is, however, referenced in sub-clause 57E, relating to choice of body for the resolution of disputes. And we agree with their assessment. And to that effect, we came up with a proposed amendment wherein we capture that which they are raising as a concern in this regard. In page 34,
you just capture it as a concern, you don't have a solution.
No, we came up with a proposed amendment today.
Okay.
Yeah. So I just didn't want to read it all over again.
Okay.
Yeah. So in page 34, the Banking Association of South Africa is of the view that there is no reference to a financial institution in sub-clause 57.7, paragraph Roman figure 1, to have the option to appeal the decision of the arbitrator to the High Court. And our response to that is that clause 57.7, sub-paragraph Roman 1, is couched in general terms to provide that a company, entity, or person may appeal the decision of the arbitrator, and it is submitted that it would include a financial institution. And in order to clarify this aspect, we came up with a proposed amendment to that effect, wherein we fully outline how that revised provision should look like. And for example, we say that the cabinet member responsible for state security or a financial institution or a financial sector regulator contemplated in section subsection 3H or company entity or person contemplated in subsection 3 paragraph Roman figure 1 may appeal the decision of the arbitrator to the High Court. Under paragraph 12.2.20, internet solution, is of the view that there is no definition of critical information infrastructure. This gives the Minister of State Security a wide discretion to declare any information infrastructure as a critical information infrastructure. We have responded to this type of question so many times before, but then I'll just, for the sake of time, respond by saying that it is submitted that clause 57.7 read with 57.12d sufficiently and narrowly defines these structures to limit the discretion of the cabinet member responsible for state security to declare critical information infrastructure. So in page 35.
Thank you, Chair. Still on page 34 on clause 57.12d. On the definition here, it defines
strictly the information infrastructure, but Mr. Mangane, you are saying it narrowly so defines critical information infrastructure. May you kindly expand on that?
So we basically are trying not to open up the definition in the sense that if we do that, then the referred official will have the entire leeway to actually deal with whatever that he needs to deal with. So by narrowing it down, we're confining him to a particular purpose or particular obligation that he needs to perform and perform only. So by narrowing it, we literally confine that official to actually focus only on that aspect that he needs to adhere to or the obligation that he needs to actually address when declaring this or coming up with the information or declaring the directives or coming up with the directives of, for the declaration of the information infrastructure. So if we don't do that and we leave it as open as that, then he will have a very broad mandate of dealing with whatever option or any aspect that deals with the conceptualization of the regulations to declare information infrastructures in a nutshell. So that's why we opted to narrow it down so as to confine him to a particular terrain that we want him to focus on. I don't know whether
let's hear what Christine wants to know. Maybe it will also give some light to what you want to know. Honorable Mutapu. Christine, you can go on.
Doesn't the critical information protection...
Oh, please speak into the mic.
Sorry. The critical information protection bill, which when I briefly looked at is much wider than obviously what is being dealt with here, but it also creates a critical infrastructure council. And my question is, you're having different structures dealing with sort of more or less similar kind of things. So what is the, I mean, to what degree is a duplication envisaged, and to what extent is, will there be a necessary overlap?
Mr. Robinson?
Thank you. Just going to deal with the question that was posed to Mr. Mangena. In terms of clause 57, I think it's sub-clause 2, critical information infrastructure is defined as certain infrastructure if they are actually involved in a cyber attack or adversely affect South Africa, its people, and everybody else. So if the Minister of State Security is going to declare critical information infrastructure, he's bound by the definition in section 57.2. And that, to a large extent, will limit his discretion in declaring critical information infrastructure. Furthermore, there's obviously dispute resolutions that can take place where a person, entity, or a company don't agree that they can be declared critical information infrastructure. There's first the administrative process through which this person can appeal his declaration of critical information infrastructure. If there's no consensus after this administrative resolution process, it must go to formal arbitration, and arbiter will then rule if it's necessary to declare this person a critical information infrastructure with reference to infrastructure that is outlined in clause 57.2. And if one of the parties is after arbitration process, obviously not satisfied with the outcome of that arbitration, they can go to a high court to further deal with the matter. So in general, it's section 57.2 writ with section 57.12d that defines the ambit of a critical information infrastructure. Regarding the second question and the operation of the Critical Information Bill and the Critical Information Infrastructure Bill, yes, there's two bills that deals with two different aspects. The names of the bills indicate that. Critical Infrastructure Bill that has been introduced in Parliament, on the one hand, mainly deals with physical structures, and on the other hand, critical information infrastructure deal with information communication technologies. To an extent, there is a clause in the Critical Infrastructure Bill to the effect that if a critical infrastructure has been identified and the Minister of Police is of the opinion that it should be dealt with in terms of the cyber bill, you must bring it to the attention of the Minister of State Security. The Minister of State Security must then consider such an application or referral to him, and if the Minister of State Security deems it necessary, by way of the fact that such a structure consists primarily of information infrastructure, it must be dealt with in terms of the cyber bill and more specifically Chapter 11 of this bill. The cyber bill was formalized after the critical information, the critical infrastructure bill, but there was consultation between the department and the civilian secretariat of the South African police on that bill, and I think there is an adequate mechanism to differentiate between infrastructure like buildings or structures on the one hand, and on the other hand, information infrastructure. There's always the argument that in certain instances information infrastructure and ordinary physical infrastructure.
Mr. Robertson, are you getting the answer to your question? Just to avoid going going on too long in attempt to just answer that question, because I thought your question was around narrowing down the definition of critical infrastructure for expediency. Okay, you're fine, Honorable Mutapo.
No, I'll take it head on with them later.
Okay, thank you. The presenter can proceed.
And that more or less, I'm almost finished with that argument, but yes, that actually defines the ambit of critical information infrastructure and ordinary information infrastructure. Where ICTs and infrastructure.
And Mr. Robinson, it's fine. I'll allow Mr. Mangena to proceed.
We're still on. We'll finish with 12.2.20. We go to page 35, paragraph B, where Internet Solutions is of the view that the minister is given wide powers to dictate critical information infrastructures to implement various measures relating to data protection. And they further indicate that it is acknowledged that protection of essential information infrastructure is necessary, but it's submitted that protection measures should not be far-reaching and obstructive. And then we respond by saying that the directives need to ensure that measures are implemented to achieve objectives and not to obstruct or frustrate their activities. Under paragraph C, they further raise a concern that a person in control of critical information infrastructure may be criminally liable if he prescribed, if the prescribed measures cannot, on a practical level, be implemented. And the further state that the criminalization of non-compliance of a directive which still needs to be drafted is unconstitutional. So we respond to that concern by stating that the rationality of a directive contemplated under Clause 57(4) can be challenged through the mechanisms provided for in Clause 57(7). And that in the event that somebody gets charged or taken to task, that person can raise a defense that the directive is not implementable. The criminalization of contravention of subordinate legislation still to be drafted in our law is still regarded as unconstitutional. So that person will have ample defense mechanisms that he can use to actually safeguard his interest. In page 36, paragraph 12.2.21, IM Consultancy is of the view that section 57(1), paragraph A, should be amended to read as follows: in consultation with the Cyber Response Committee and the Information Regulator. We have responded to the issue relating to the participation of the Information Regulator in this bill, and I'll just briefly indicate our response as follows: that we feel that the Information Regulator should not actually play an active role in this terrain, because then now that will compromise her independence and credibility in the eyes of the general public. So it's better if the Information Regulator is left to exercise her powers under the realm of POPIA Act. Under paragraph 12.2.22, IM Consultancy is of the view that the categorization of the information infrastructure as contemplated in section 57(2) should exclude critical information infrastructure holding or compromising personal information. Our response is that according to such an argument, the databases of the Department of Home Affairs and the DS office should be excluded. And it is submitted that this recommendation does not take into account the reality of cybersecurity and the need to protect systems that process and store this essential information. So up until people realize the magnitude of what cybercrime can do to such databases, only then will they know how important it is to regulate them. So under paragraph B, clause 57(3), so they say, 57(3), subparagraph Roman figure 1, the POPIA defines personal information as being...
So, in terms of this question, Mr. Mayan, are you saying you don't agree with IM Consultants in this regard, in terms of the leak, especially in terms of that leak, the 33 million South African citizens' personal information? What's your comment on that?
Well, I don't agree with their what they are proposing, because then now such databases need to be jealously guarded and protected. The fact that there was this loss of this information, it probably could be attributed to something else. Either there were no proper defense mechanisms in place, or somebody just deliberately leaked such information. I wouldn't be in a position to tell. But what I'm trying to confirm is that I'm totally against what they are proposing, because those databases have got serious, critical, important information that should not even be easily accessible. For example, Home Affairs has got the death register, birth, citizenship, marriage. So imagine if somebody has got that information at their hands like that. It will be such a... So I'm not... I don't agree with what they're saying.
So in that regard, then in that regard, do you mean that it will be copier of this one in terms of that information?
critical information?
It will be chapter 11 of the bill, because it will be regarded as critical information. Remember, under the definition...
No, I'm covered, because I was thinking, you said it's not important and so forth.
Mm-hmm. It is important, because remember, you remember those five, elements that we mentioned, that if it's going to compromise the safety of the public and the citizens, the economy, all those things, they fall under that chapter, and then obviously then this will fall into that chapter as well.
As of now, because this has not come into effect as an act, so in terms of that information of the state is 3 million South Africans, so in the meantime, what is obtaining? Is it 4 years or what?
Mr. Robinson?
Thank you, Mr. Chief. Thank you, Jay. First, currently, the only legislation that we have identified that could probably be applicable is Chapter 9 of the Electronic Communications Act, which relate to critical databases. The offences that could be applicable to such leaked information is very limited in terms of the ECTA, the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act. And other than that, I don't think there's actually legislation that do deal with this.
Thank you, Chair.
Maybe also just to take into consideration what the Chapter 7 said about harmful information. I don't know whether maybe you could actually manage to break it down, because what you have actually how you responded to this was that it's actually catered for in other pieces of legislation. From the JCPS cluster, what would actually be concerned with it if there's information that would actually circulate that would disturb peace and stability? How is that going to be handled? Where is it handled? So that we don't continue developing legislation with the impression that some of these critical areas are covered in other pieces of legislation, when you actually say there are gaps that we are actually leaving.
Okay, regarding harmful communications that is harmful or that can harm South Africa currently, I think firstly, if it's of a large magnitude, there is a provision in the National Strategic Intelligence Act that do provide the State Security Agency with certain powers to secure critical databases and infrastructure in South Africa. They can act in that. Regarding harmful, do you mean if the communication can harm somebody?
Can bring instability.
Instability.
Because, you know, yeah, at the end of the day, JCPS cluster, one of our responsibilities is to ensure that we continue to have peace and stability in the country. And once there is in circulation information that has an intent of disturbing peace and stability in South Africa, how do we handle it? Which legislation is actually catering for this kind of communication?
Ma'am, I think it's mostly security legislation that deals with that. I did refer to the National Strategic Intelligence Act.
Can I maybe ask you to look into it and respond to it accordingly, because what we need to avoid is to proceed with the impression that this is properly catered for somewhere, just to avoid the situation where we'll have gaps in terms of the legislation that we have. Because this is about cyber security, and what comes out is that it cannot actually be catered for in this piece of legislation. Is catered for somewhere, but let's know where is it catered for, where is the somewhere, and that somewhere needs to be articulated properly.
We will look at it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're still in paragraph 12.2.22, page 36. Paragraph B, IM Consultancy continues to state that clause 57.3 sub Roman figure 1 states that the POPIA defines personal information as being the property of the data subject. It will be impossible to consult with each and every data subject whose personal information is under consideration to be declared a critical information infrastructure. Our response to that concern is that the aim of declaring critical information infrastructure is to ensure that additional protection measures are put in place to deal with cyber vulnerabilities. So there's no requirement in POPIA that persons whose personal information is assigned special protection need to be consulted. They further go on to say that in clause 57.7, paragraph A, it is impossible for a person to dispute the decision of a cabinet member unless represented by information regulator. And we are of the view that the information regulator has its own remedies in terms of the POPIA to enforce compliance. So, and again, the information regulator does not have the powers to represent a wrong party in a dispute. Then we come to page 38, where we will be talking about clause 58, which deals with auditing of critical information infrastructures to ensure compliance. Cell C, Telkom and Vodacom raised the concern that the obligations that the owner or a person in control of the cost of an audit of a critical information infrastructure should be reviewed. And our response to that is that King 3 code brings IT management into the domain of corporate governance. And from this perspective, cost of compliance is an integral part of the day-to-day running of a business, and costs related thereto should be borne by a company in question. IM Consultancy, in paragraph 12.3.2, is of the view that reference to compliance directives should be substituted with compliance with appropriate and generally accepted international information standards. They further elaborate that in clause 58.3, there is a general shortage of skills, and it is admitted that the state security agency would probably not be in a position to monitor the adequacy of such an audit. And we respond to that by stating that clause 58.3 provides for capacity constraints in that it provides that the Director General of State Security may appoint any other person to monitor the effectiveness of an audit. They further raise the question as to whether it is possible to monitor an audit, since the result will only be known at the end of an audit. And then we respond to that by saying that it is admitted that the actions taken during an audit and the extent of an audit can be monitored. And they further raise another concern that clause 58.5 read with 58.11d compels the owner of an information infrastructure to provide the DG of State Security additional information as may be necessary to evaluate the report. And the question is asked whether the intention is to allow a backdoor access to the state. And our response to that concern is that the purposes of a request for additional information in clause 58.5 is to acquire additional information to evaluate the audit report, which may, for instance, entail specifications of a software that is implemented to secure access and nothing more. So they further raise another concern that clause 58.6b, in that clause, the requirement of the satisfaction of the DG State Security is vague, and it must be kept in mind that an independent auditor is involved. And then we are of the view that Clause 58.4, which provides that reporting must be done in the prescribed form and manner, which provides for an objective and standards compliance. IM consultancy, in page 40, in paragraph 12.3.7, raises a concern that clause 58.8 provides that the state security DG may nominate auditors at its discretion to conduct an audit. However, no qualifications or additional requirements seem to be necessary. Certain specific requirements are suggested. Well, clause 58, subsection 13, in our response, we say that it specifically provides that the cabinet member responsible for state security must, by notice in the Gazette, prescribe persons or category or class of persons who are competent to be appointed to perform an audit as contemplated in this section. So it is submitted that only competent and qualified persons can be appointed. They further raise the concern that clause 58.11, which deals with the scope of an audit, which is the audit compliance with clause directives, but should be substituted with generally accepted international information standards. And we responded to that concern earlier on in paragraph 12.2.15. So I'm not going to repeat it here. So we jump over there. Okay.
Okay, thanks. The application on page 89 under 12.3.4. Yeah, I am consulting where they are asking, where it says the question is asked whether it is possible to monitor an audit since the results will only be known at the end of an audit. I see your response, they are saying it is submitted that the actions taken during an audit and the extent of an audit can be monitored. How? How do you monitor an audit while it's still in session, while they are still auditing? How do you monitor that?
An official from that department can accompany the auditor or the person who's assigned to conduct that audit to go and be an observer. He can be there to observe what actually is taking place and observe and make up his own conclusions with regards to that. And only after the auditor has compiled his report will he be in a position to actually see what the report entails. But the extent and what takes place during the audit itself can be monitored. You can observe and see what's actually taking place.
Will that not be disruptive, you know, when officials are doing the work and the public then is free to come and be observing, and is that not going to be disruptive?
Mr. Chairperson, this is related to a specific clause in the bill where there's an obligation that an audit of a critical information infrastructure must take place to ensure that certain security measures is implemented. In terms of the bill, there's a clause that the Minister of State Security may, when an audit is performed by a private auditor, ensure that certain people accompany the auditor. It will be officials from State Security. And it's only during that period of the audit. The critical infrastructure must audit. You will know the audit will take place, and the audit must take place by a specialist. The people that accompanies the auditor will merely look how it takes place. So my submission, if there is any disruption, it is a necessity. It's a statutory obligation that must be complied with, and the persons that must accompany the auditor is not given any, or is not empowered in any way to deal with systems or to actively participate in the audit.
So it's regulated, it's not something that can just... Christine? Honorable Skosana, you covered.
Yeah, well, if it's regulated, I'm covered. Though I think the people who will be conducting that audit, they will feel intimidated. But, you know, I'm covered.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, if you are doing your work, there's somebody just sitting here, you're not saying anything, but just observing. I think you would, as kind of normal circumstances, feel intimidated.
Okay, and they will still engage with it. But for now, can we proceed on that basis?
I just want some clarity around this clause 58. Is that applicable really to private digital information? So then what happens in the case of organs of state?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Organs of the state, as well as certain private information infrastructures, may be declared critical information infrastructure. The obligation to audit will be on the department who hosts that information infrastructure, and everything that is prescribed in Clause 58 will equally be applicable to information infrastructures under the control of the state.
Thank you. Page 41, paragraph 12.3.10, IM Consultancy raises this concern that clause 58, subsection 12 provision is problematic. They feel that it ignores the complexity and the highly technical nature of processing and the skills availability within the auditing community. It also ignores the audit time and cost involved. It refers to adequacy and effectiveness of an audit, something very few people can determine. And we respond to this by saying that the provision merely states that a person commits an offence if he or she hinders or obstructs or improperly attempts to influence any member of the state security agency, person or entity to monitor, evaluate and report on the adequacy and effectiveness of an audit. And following up on that, they raised the following concern that the reason someone fails to assist or provide technical assistance and support to a person authorized to carry out an audit could be a lack of skill or confidence to offer assistance. And then we respond to this by saying that the provision in question will only be applicable where there is failure to comply with auditing requirements. Freedom of religion in paragraph 12.3.11 is of the view that auditing mechanism may interfere with private entities allowing the state to invade privately owned data, devices, networks or infrastructures and may infringe on constitutional right to privacy. Our response is that Clause 58 was specifically framed to ensure that SSA as a controlling entity does not directly gain access to the systems, data and storage devices of a private entity that has been declared a critical information infrastructure. And there are safeguards in place to ensure that that doesn't happen. It is also a requirement that an auditor appointed in terms of Clause 58.6 must be accompanied by a person from the infrastructure during audit. And so part of this will respond to the concern Honorable Skosana raised with regards to that aspect that we are concerned about. And this brings us to the end of Chapter 11, dealing with infrastructure, critical information infrastructures. If there are no questions, then I'll move over to Chapter 12, which deals with agreements with foreign states. So, in Clause 59, we say that national executives may enter into agreement. And to that effect, CLC, Telkom and Vodacom commented that current procedures for mutual assistance between South Africa and foreign countries in the investigation of cyber crime do not effectively take into account the transient nature of electronic evidence and the need to act expeditiously. And the resultant effect is that essential evidence is lost. And our response is that the format of evidence that is required is usually specified in the request, and in cyber matters, are aimed at ensuring the integrity of information. So the standard operating procedures in Clause 24 further deals with aspects of evidence collection and preservation. And in Clause 46(6) of the bill, the designated judge regulates aspects relating to the preservation of evidence as is specified in a request for mutual assistance. And the fact that a member of National Prosecuting Authority must assist the 24/7 point of contact will further ensure that regard will be had to the requirements of admissibility of evidence in a foreign state. So that's in an essence what is contained in chapter 12. So in chapter 13, we deal with general provisions. And so in clause 60, we're saying the National Director of Public Prosecutions must keep statistics of prosecutions. And CLC, Telkom and Vodacom commented that the obligation on SEPs to report these same statistics should be reviewed to ensure accurate reporting of these crimes, and not only those that actually make it to court. This will also contribute towards accurate reporting on how effective investigations into these types of offenses are and what percentage of cases actually result in prosecutions. And our response to that is that provisions of Clause 60 must be read with Clause 54(2)(c) that imposes obligations on the Minister of Police to report to Parliament on the offences that were reported to SEPs, cases that resulted in criminal prosecutions, and cases where no criminal prosecutions were instituted after a period of 18 months after a case was reported. This will ensure a comprehensive picture of the nature and extent of cybercrime in the Republic, as well as the Republic's ability to deal with this type of crime. And we further comment or respond by saying that Chapter 11 of the Act also provides checks and balances to evaluate the effectiveness of the protection measures that were implemented to protect most essential information systems in the Republic. And in under paragraph 14.1.2, All Rise commented that the instruction to the Director of Public Prosecution in Section 60 of the bill to keep and disclose statistics relating to clauses 16, 17, and 18 is important. However, transparency and data insight will play a critical part in addressing cyber abuse. And we respond to that comment or submission that the obligation of the Minister of Police is to report to Parliament. And as although the prosecution of malicious communications may not be a police priority, the required statistics of crimes that have been reported will provide insights to the extent of cyber abuse. And this in turn may give rise to further law reform to cap such abuses. And this brings us to the end of chapter 13. And I don't know if there are any questions with regards to chapter 12 and 13.
Honorable members, do we want to engage with that chapter before we move on? Doesn't seem so.
proceed.
So without further instruction, my colleague will continue with the last chapter, which deals with general amendments. Thank you.
Thank you very much,
thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Clause 61 is part of the general provisions of the chapter, and Clause 61, amongst others, refers to laws that is amended in the schedule or repealed in the schedule to the bill. I'm going to concentrate on certain amendments that is proposed to the Sexual Offences Act and comments that were received by the Internet Service Providers Association mainly, as well as the other person, I think it's Liquid Telecommunications. The first comment is on page 45, it's discussed in paragraph 4.2.1, and the proposal is made that the definition of electronic communication service provider that is proposed should be aligned with the definition of electronic communication service provider that is proposed in the bill. We agree to that provision, and on page 45 we also propose amendment to the definition to be inserted in the Sexual Offences Act to bring it in line with the definition of electronic communication service provider in the bill. In paragraph 14.2.2, ISPA suggested that all other provisions in the Films and Publications Act that deals with child pornography should be repealed and inserted, either be repealed or inserted in the Sexual Offences Act insofar as it is applicable, if it's not dealt with in the amendment that is proposed to the Sexual Offences Act, and which is contained in the proposed clause, or rather section 19A. Our submission is that we do agree to that, but certain definitions need to stay in the Films and Publications Act, amongst others the definition of child pornography. That definition is necessary for purposes of the Films and Publications Act to classify certain publications as publications that cannot be distributed, amongst others, if it contains child pornography. I'm not going to go into detail about all the amendments that needs to be affected. One is, amongst others, Section 27A of the Films and Publications Act that deals with certain obligations on internet service providers. Those same obligations is inserted in the Sexual Offences Act by means of the proposed Section 19A. There is, however, other clauses in the Films and Publications Act that probably also need to be amended. Amongst others, Section 30B1B of the Films and Publications Act that contains a presumption to the effect that if a person access child pornography by way of electronic communication service, it is deemed that the register owner, who is the owner of the service, is the person who accessed that services. Our submission is that that might raise some constitutional issues. We will further research that, but that will probably not be inserted in the Sexual Offences Act. So in order to accommodate the proposals, we did propose amendments to the schedule, which is on page 49 of the bill, and we indicate that we can probably delete section 24B, 27A, and possibly also section 30B1B of the Sexual Offences Act. I did indicate previously that regarding further amendments to the Films and Publications Act, we need to consult with the Films and Publications Board and the Department of Communications. A meeting was scheduled for a week ago, but the persons were involved in other activities, and so that did not take place. But we will, in due course, consult with the people regarding this amendment. And on page 50, ISPA pointed out that currently, in terms of the proposed amendments to the Sexual Offences Act, child-time material must be disabled to ensure that no access is provided to persons who want to access child pornography. And ISPA pointed out that in such instances, some law enforcement agencies in some instances require that the webpage be kept in place in order to facilitate further investigation of child harm material. Our submission is that this is a very contentious issue. There is a current investigation by the South African Law Reform Commission regarding child pornography, which may include this aspect. In child pornography, the underlying basis is usually every time a child is viewed, who participate in child pornography, in every instance you actually infringes on the dignity of that child. So this needs careful balancing. Our submission is that we do not want to deal with this aspect in the proposed amendments to the Sexual Offences Act. However, there is other legislation which is currently being reviewed regarding investigative procedures in cyberspace, and according to us, it's more appropriate to deal with this contentious aspect in that other legislation. Mr. Chairperson, that brings us to the end of our responses to the comments. If there's no further questions, I think then we're finished.
I must say that you have done very, very well under very difficult circumstances, and we would like to commend you for that. I'm not meaning to preempt the honorable members, but you deserve that comment. And the honorable members, we have come to the end of that presentation. Is there anything that we want to raise, Honorable Majake?
It's on clause 11.4.5 for freedom of religion. I didn't quite understand their concern about information that will be withheld. Do you want to just explain that one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. 11.4.1 is on page 13, and that relates to the sharing of information. In terms of clause 56 of the bill, there is a clause that says the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development must make regulations to share information regarding cyber vulnerabilities that takes place. I already indicated that information sharing will ensure that information that may infringe on privacy of a person will not be distributed. And I think their concern is that due to the fact that restrictions is imposed on that regulation or on the sharing of information to scrap it from certain identifiable information may actually be used to withheld information from civil society. It's our submission that such restrictions is absolutely necessary. It must be in line with the Protection of Personal Information Act and the Protection of the POPI Act will not allow us to divulge information of a certain person to other entities to evaluate cyber vulnerabilities that takes place. Our submission is that it's probably a wrong perception regarding the real the real purpose of that bill.
Yeah, Honourable Jack is happy about that.
It's actually answered, because even if it's freedom of religion, they're not concerned about distribution of religious information. They are concerned about information that relates to NGO work. Okay.
Honourable Tumulano.
Having listened in my absence to what you said and agreeing with.
Intuitively, intuitively, it's possible, Honorable.
I want to come to what I asked yesterday. I was not quite happy with. the minimum amount that on the question of trying to say you don't want to put police in a corner, that they have to, that everything must be reported to them. I just want to find out the harm that is likely to be done by that vis-a-vis the interests of the majority of the people, where my 2,000, for example, to me, is like 100,000 to a rich person. And if it affects the ordinary people on the ground. I understand the problem you have. What you're trying to do is to try to make it practically possible that the police will handle in as much as they can afford to do so. And you have to have a cutoff and so on. But would you have some other way of solving that? And certainly the question of the initiative of the police in identifying the issues that is coupled to that. Or what would you say that they are the ones who say, okay, these are reportable. These are, you don't have to worry. I'm trying to find out the things that affect the majority of the people in that. I think if you get my point, that.
Thank you.
Any
other? Proceed to deal with the two.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. I believe yesterday we did discuss the clause that deals with the obligations on financial institutions and electronic communication service providers to report certain offences to the South African police. And that shall be prescribed by the Minister of South African Police Services by way of regulation. I did also indicate that ordinary cybercrime can be reported irrespective of the amount involved. That is an ordinary crime and it must be reported. What we deal with in that reporting clause is mainly to ensure that service providers and financial institutions which actually host the systems on which the crimes are committed is placed under obligation to report certain crimes to the police for statistical purposes, and secondly, there's obligation on them to retain certain information which may help to facilitate the investigation of a cyber crime. I did take cognizance of the fact, I indicated in my response in the appropriate place that the current amount will probably be an amount of 50,000, which would be regarded as a reportable crime. I think that is the issue that needs to be addressed. Our submission is currently the police will probably be overrun with the reporting of each and every crime that is in Chapter 2 of the Bill that is reported or committed against a system of electronic communication service provider or a financial institution. But I see the point that it will not give a full and comprehensive oversight of the actual crime in South Africa, especially most cyber crimes involve relatively low amounts like 1,000 rand or 2,000 rand, etc. To deal with that, I believe the cyber hub, that is a structure that needs to be established in terms of Chapter 10 of the bill, has got a reporting facility where ordinary persons that were subject to a cyber crime can report the cyber crime to the cyber hub. And I think eventually when the cyber hub is fully functional, it will also give advice to persons how to further deal and and advice to secure themselves against cyber attacks and possible cyber crime. From a statistical point of view, I think most of the relatively lower crimes that are supported to the CyberArt will also influence further steps that needs to be taken. That will be available in the database of the CyberArt. So from that perspective, the CyberArt can probably cater for that initiative to ensure that each and every person that is subject to a cybercrime can at least bring it to the attention of the authorities. On the other hand, they must report. It's in the discretion to report each and every cybercrime that's committed against them, irrespective of the amount, to the South African police services so that they can investigate and possibly prosecute the cyber criminal. So the only measure is probably through the cyber art.
Follow up?
I don't know, can you come to my level? By cyber art. Let me explain my fear. My fear is an act which is seen to be biased towards the rich people. Because in most cases, as you agree with me, that it will be 2,000, 5,000 which belong to the majority of them, whereas the 50,000 and so on will be, if you could understand what is meant by Zabahab, how it's going to be helping the statistics of so the police can be able to.
That process. Mr. Chairperson, in terms of clause 54 of the bill, the CyberArt must be established in the Department of Telecommunication and Postal Services. The CyberArt's main has got various functions. One function is to act as a connection between government on the one hand and the private sector. On the other hand, the obligations of the CyberArt is to ensure that information about cyber irregularities is brought to the attention of the general public. As part of the functioning of the CyberArt, a specific obligation can be included to specifically ensure that each and every person that is the victim of a cybercrime may report that to the CyberArt for statistical purposes. Remember, clause 58 is merely a tool that relates to statistics. If we make that obligation specifically applicable to the CyberArt, that can be used for statistical purposes as well. And we can obtain that from the CyberArt. But in general, due to the fact that the bill has certain controlling functions, amongst others that certain cybercrimes must be reported to the police, the police must table a report once a year in Parliament about progress that is made in investigation of cyber crimes, as well as obligation on the National Prosecuting Authority to also in their report include information about cases that they prosecute. It will act as checks and balances to ensure that we can see if progress has been made regarding the investigation and prosecution of cyber crime. But yes, to an extent, I agree, we can probably facilitate statutory reporting requirements to the CyberArt so that they specifically do facilitate that.
Mrs. Pillay, do you want to say something?
No, Chair, there's nothing from my side except if I think you answered my question about how we proceed further. So, that's...
Okay, I guess we will allow you to go back and effect the necessary changes, and early next year then we will come back to the bill and deal with it clause by clause. And after that, I guess you will give the two gentlemen 2 months paid leave to go and write a textbook on cyber crimes, so that we all can read. But they've done very, very well. Okay.
Thank you, Chief.
That brings us to the end of that part. Honorable members, may we release them and then go on with our other business. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think just let us know about the progress in that constitutional matter. You remember there's a case before the Concord that has a bearing on this.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you don't have to come. Yeah, you can just keep us posted, or when you come back next year, let us know about it. Honorable members, there are reports before us for consideration. The first one is the report on the request for the National Assembly to institute removal proceedings against the public protector in terms of Section 194 of the Constitution. The short report that has been distributed, have we all read it, or do you need some 3, 5, 4 minutes to have a fresh look at it and the recommendation? Honorable Lahon, did we give it?
Yes, Chairperson, as you said, a short report, and I would think that it would not be complete without us dealing with the committee's deliberations and decisions of the 10th of October as well. The report is completely silent on our deliberations and our decisions on the 10th of October.
Which one are you referring to?
You will recall that's the day where we first dealt with the matter, and there was discussion as to whether an ad hoc committee or the portfolio committee would be the proper forum to deal with the, I don't want to say investigation, because later members argued that that was not the decision taken. But the 10th, we dealt with the issue which committee would be the proper vehicle to deal with the request.
That matter was settled.
Now, I understand that, but that was part of the whole way in which this committee dealt with the request. So, in my view, it would be an incomplete report if we do not report on the deliberations and the decisions taken on the 10th of October as well.
Honourable members, do you follow what honourable member is saying? What are you saying, honourable Majak?
I think for the purpose of the records, I think we need to identify which report reference is being made to, because we've got three reports before us, so that we understand the concern about the 10th of November. Which report are you referring to, Honourable Hall?
I'm referring to the one under discussion.
The one
that Chair introduced.
The under discussion is the one relating to the institution of removal proceedings against the public protector. And the report before you captures what has happened and the recommendation of the committee. What else do you want? What else do you want to add your
I think what he's relating to is covered on... Is it not covered on page 2? Item 3.
You are right, Honourable Mchapo. Honourable Hoyle, read to paragraph 3.
No, I have read it, Chair. The fact of the matter is, in the spirit of cooperation, I will not say that there is now selective amnesia in this committee. but I really want to say that. On the 10th of October we met.
Mm-hmm.
There was a view from you as the Chair that this committee might not have the capacity in terms of time to deal with this matter. Ultimately, some members went out on caucus, and ultimately we even voted on the issue whether this committee or an ad hoc committee should deal with the request. And none of that is encapsulated in this report.
Okay, you have raised the issue, Honourable Maila.
No. Thank you very much, Chair. I understand what Honourable Hon is saying, but this report is the report emanating out of the decision of the 10th. Because on the 10th, we made a decision that this committee will deal with the matter. So this report is the report on how the committee dealt with the matter. And I think it suffices.
Honourable, when an issue is before us, we debate it, we will have various views, the Chair may also have his views, but at the end, the decision of the committee is what matters, not what individuals had to say. So the report is about the outcome of the deliberations, unless you want a transcript of the deliberations.
No, Chair, and we don't need to regurgitate that you at the time held a different view than the rest of your party. In my respectful view, however, we will not report on the full actions of this committee in respect of the request if we do not report at all on what transpired on the 10th.
No, with respect, the purpose of deliberations is that each and every member, including the chairperson, should express themselves on the issues before on the table. But the position of the majority is the position of the committee,
and no one has status when it comes to that. So whether you are a chairperson or not, you don't have a special position or status, because the committee is the competent body to take the decision. And the committee has taken the decision after full deliberations. And so this report duly reflect on that. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I Honorable Ron has heard me. Honorable, we can continue. Honorable Tapo.
Okay. Continue. Can I rectify something?
Yes.
Yes. On item one, paragraph one, sorry. I think it should be proper if we insert the year. I don't know whether it's 2017 or 2016. The Speaker of National Assembly received a letter dated 13 September. A year should be inserted.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Dated the 15th November 2017. Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable
Majaki. Thank you, Chairperson. Under bullet number 1, 2, 3, I think that dog must be doing. In doing. Can we correct that?
That is doing. Oh, okay. Yes. No, that is very fast. Any other correction on page one? If none, any other correction on page two? Yeah, Honorable Mutapo.
Just a substitute question on paragraph four, whereby it stated that those three parties have disagreed. Is it proper for us to give a dissenting view, like it's always done in judgment, court judgment? I don't know. Clarity thinking in that regard.
No, you are the committee. What are you saying?
I was supposing that because the committee,
we're deliberating as a committee. Now, if the committee has eventually agreed, or majority of members in that committee have taken a certain route, is it proper then to also come again and say this party X and Y and Z didn't agree? I don't think it's proper.
The rules don't, as far as I understand them, prohibit that, but let's see what other members are saying. Honorable Hon.
You know, once again, Chair, I think not to state that there was firmly held beliefs by minority parties that the counter view must prevail would be, in my opinion, create a situation where we do not properly report to the National Assembly.
It may be not correct to use words like follow a rational process, because when you disagree, it doesn't mean that other people are acting irrational.
Yeah, no, but the rational process do not necessarily, although it obviously will apply in this instance, but the rational process was part of the argument.
You see, a
process that another step or two has to be taken before the committee can decide on whether there is a case to be answered.
A process is either a due process or an undue process. Rational process means something else. So I don't think rational is the right word to use. The process was a due process that was followed.
The ACDQ was here.
Any correction?
Any other? Can I hear Honorable Mpungwan first?
Yes, I just was going to raise that. I would probably say
these parties did not agree with the decision of the majority.
Mm.
Full stop.
Full stop.
And there are various reasons they were preparing, and so therefore I don't think that we'll take one.
Honorable,
my argument is that this is not the first report that this committee dealt with, and some parties didn't agree on certain reports, but it was never stated. What is making this report very special to state or a party? In most cases, the DA, always reserves its judgment, but it's never stated. But what is making this report so special to say to the party XYZ, parties XYZ didn't agree to the report? That's my concern.
Honorable,
we are taking a very bad case.
Honorable.
I'm supporting Honorable Mbumblana's suggestion that we just indicated a DA, ACDP, and EFF disagree to the position. And then you don't go on to say, to follow. It's as if they were singing the same song when they were actually putting different views forward. So it just indicated that they did not agree with the position that was reached.
But did you hear what Honorable Mutapoy says?
I hear what she says, and if she advocates for removal of the paragraph that is problematic, I still will support it. And it's because of the fact that this is setting precedents in terms of how the reports of this committee are supposed to be written as compared to what used to happen in the past. And the big question is, why in this case is it so important for this paragraph to be pulled out and really clearly explained or tried to
one may ask
the view of the opposition.
If we have 100 parties, we will name all the 100 parties, we will have space.
And their views.
Because the parties still have the right in the House to express their views. Honorable Maine.
Thanks, Chair. I fully align myself with Honorable Mutapo that we record the decision of the committee without necessarily saying who was saying what and who was not saying what.
Honorable Horn, do you have something to say further?
No, all I want to say is the committee can sanitize this as much as they want. We all know what travesty happened on the day, so let's debate it in the House.
Okay, thank you. We remove the paragraph and proceed
to okay, fine.
The whole paragraph.
The whole paragraph.
Yes.
And the recommendation says, having considered the request for the National Assembly to institute removal proceedings against the public protector in terms of Section 194 of the Constitution, the committee resolved that there was no basis for Parliament to institute removal proceedings against the public protector. You are very vigilant. That's what is expected of members of Parliament. Thank you very much.
Adoption.
Honorable Mutapo moves for adoption of the report. Any seconder?
Second.
Honorable Maila seconds the adoption. So the report. Those in favor of the adoption, I said Honorable Mutapo moved, Honorable Maila, now we need to count them.
Mm.
Yes. It's six members against how many? Who is against one?
I think Honorable Maile supported Honorable
No, no, no. You know, he was just slow in blowing down his voice.
Some members want to have
quiet. There's six members in favor and one against. Then we move to the deputy. The report says a request for the National Assembly to institute an inquiry into alleged misconduct of the Deputy Public Protector, dated 15th November 2017. Any corrections on page 1? Yes.
Paragraph 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, where it says the first line, section 7.9, I think it would be proper if we mention of which legislation, I guess it's Public Protector Act, because
this will
be a public document. Thank you,
Chair. Oh, you are correct, Honorable Mutapo, thank you. Honorable Hon.
Yes, Chair, also on paragraph 3, the second sentence which says the letter indicates that an internal investigation into the matter is at an advanced stage. But the way I understood the letter is that the public protector in fact answered to say the investigation into the complaint is not in an advanced stage. So the perception on the part of the complainant that the investigation was stopped was not correct. So this is not an internal investigation. It's in fact the investigation into the original complaint that was lodged. So I think internal should be removed.
Yeah, I agree with Honorable Hon. The investigation is still going on.
Honorable Hon, your interpretation is correct.
Mm-hmm.
Honorable Majake agrees with you. Anyone who is against Honorable Hon and Honorable Majake?
Okay.
Honorable Pumulon?
No, it's not. Can I get
more clarity on what you say? What exactly is being investigated, which is at advanced stage? Is it what has been complained of, or is it about the Deputy Public Protector? What was the response of this? How did Mem Kwewane respond in that way? Was he addressing the question of the issue about the Deputy Public Protector, or was he addressing about the issue of investigation of what was supposed to be in, they are being complained about that by the vis-à-vis the Deputy Public Protector? I'm saying, can that be clarified here? Because we're dealing with a complaint that the Deputy Public Protector did not do A, B, C, and D. And then we were to check that. And then we say, no, let's not do that, because that is being done internally by the Public Protector. Or the issue that we're complaining about is in fact being done.
Honorable Maila?
No, the issue is clarified on item 2, on what was at stake, that the Deputy Public Protector unlawfully terminated an investigation.
Yeah, but what is being terminated done now?
What is in the next?
What is it in advance?
Use the mic, please.
It is the investigation into the alleged...
what is in the letter?
No, the letter says that currently the investigation on this matter is at an advanced stage where the Section 7.9 notice will be issued.
So which means the process is going on?
The process is ongoing and at an advanced stage, yes.
Yeah, it belongs there. It doesn't belong here.
Mm.
So for us, we have no issue to deal with it.
But the issue is what is raised by Honorable Hon, that we should remove the issue of the internal investigation, just to indicate that
the investigation is ongoing.
Yeah. Can we maybe recraft it? Maybe that sentence needs to be recrafted because it's based on the response of the public protector to the office of the speaker. The contents of that letter indicates that this investigation that is alleged to have been stopped is continuing.
Mm.
So I think that's how this needs to be captured.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. I would agree.
So, Christine, I guess this takes care of the issue. Oh, you want to say something? No, we have a
What I'm actually saying is that this paragraph has got to do with the letter that was written by the public protector to the office of the speaker responding to the allegations that the deputy public protector stopped an investigation on the mayor and the municipal manager of Ekurhuleni.
Mm-hmm.
So the letter indicates that the investigation is still on.
Mm.
So I think when you recraft this sentence, it must indicate that out of that letter, it indicates that the investigation is continuing.
As the official position from that office.
Yes.
So this committee cannot create another position.
Yes.
Any corrections, any further corrections, Honorable Majak?
Chairperson, I think I don't see the need for number four. In actual fact, it's confusing. Can we just remove it?
No, actually, it's out of order.
Mm.
And the recommendation is that the committee resolve that there is no basis for the National Assembly to conduct an inquiry into alleged misconduct by the Deputy Public Protector as requested pending the outcome of the Public Protector's investigation. No, we don't have to fight because that's a consequential matter.
Mm-hmm.
When we delete four, it necessarily means that we amend number, we stop at as requested. There's no, the committee resolved that there's no basis for the National Assembly to conduct an inquiry into alleged misconduct by the Deputy Public Protector is requested. Full stop.
Mm. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
And then we stop it. I move for adoption.
Honorable Majake moves for adoption. Honorable Tapo seconds. Can we take the hands? How many people support the adoption?
With the necessarily amended.
Yes.
As amended. That's the lawyer say as amended. All of us unanimous. Now he's a member of this committee. You see, we act as a committee. And we reserve the right to differ as well as. The next one is let's just do this one. The next report is on the remedial action in the Public Protector State Capture Report number 6 of 2016-17 dated 17 November 2017. Any correction on page 1? No correction. On page 2, on page 3, if there are no
can you be consistent? We seem to be reporting date by date. You are coming back to what the one was.
Just correct.
I say, all I'm saying that um, to, I just want to be guided here. I'm not putting the final word. All I'm saying is that, is there anything important in saying on certain date this is agreed, on certain date this is what happened, in addressing to the report, or are we saying that the committee decided to call the fund on the basis of this to do A, B, C, and D on the matter, or are we saying each day to you, let's say this is what happened that day, this is what happened on the other day. What I'm saying is that can we be consistent and talk about the issues and the, how we dealt with the issues and what was the final decision of the matter.
What can members say? What date are you worried about? Because this is a story that unfolded. So the National Assembly needs to be able to see the journey that we took to arrive at that, you know. And the researchers in future need to know what road we traveled. It doesn't do any harm anywhere. If there's no prejudice and it enhances for page 8, paragraph 8 maybe, your point is relevant to paragraph 8. The committee met on the 1st, 8th and 15th November 20 to continue deliberating on the remedial action. We removed the 15th, the committee met on the 1st and 8th.
Mm.
Yeah, and then today is the 15th. Thanks, Honorable Mpumlwana, for pointing that out. And the recommendations are as follows. The committee therefore recommends that the National Assembly requests the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services to investigate possible shortcomings in the legal framework regulating the ethical conduct applicable to executive members, including the specific aspects of the remedial action in paragraph 8.9 of the State of Capture Report as it relates to the Executive Members Ethics Act 1998 that may require legislative amendment, and to introduce this to Parliament as a matter of urgency. The National Assembly refer consideration of a transversal code of conduct for all employees of the state to the Department of Public Service and Administration for further investigation. Those who support the adoption, Christine?
Just with regard to the second recommendation, we say refer to the department, and perhaps it should go to the Ministry of Public Service and Administration.
The department, ne?
Yes.
Or the minister, thank you. Can we take instead of department, Ministry of Public Service and Administration? That's paragraph 11.2. Can we get a proposal for adoption, Honorable Maila?
I propose adoption of the report, Chairperson.
Any seconder? Honorable Sosana? Can we take hands for those who support the adoption of the report? How many? Seven support the adoption of the report, and those against, six support the adoption of the report.
And one. Jay, will you just record the fact that we reserve our position?
Honorable Lon, that's fair. Okay. The Honorable Lon, on behalf of the DA, reserve the position. Okay.
from the necessary issue.
Oh, yes. Honorable Hon, do you want to say something?
Yes, Chair, there was another matter on the agenda.
Yeah. Yes, that's one, what we are going to now.
Okay.
It doesn't mean that it's done, but we can do it.
Honorable members. Members, unless there are intervening discussions, may I proceed? There was a recommendation from the minister, from the magistrate commission that came through us from the minister for the removal of three magistrates, Stearman, Hole and Priwa, and we in principle agreed with the recommendation, but some information had not come to hand, and the information was subsequently made available, and when the information was considered, we then had to take the final decision. But as matters stand now, we can only deal with two matters, that of Stearman and Holland, and I will explain why only the two, and let's deal with those two. Anyone who has a problem with our principle, with our agreement to support the removal of the two, Stearman and Holland, or let's put it otherwise, can we take a proposal for the removal of the two magistrates, Stearman and Holland? Honorable members, since your meeting, you agreed that you approve this in principle. Now, what is your position today? You have the right to change your minds. Honorable Maila?
No, we won't change our minds, Chairperson. We agreed in principle, but you said there is some information that you need to share.
No, no, this is in respect of Priva. I'm dealing with the other two. Yeah.
We wanted to deal with all of them.
No. Let's deal with two. We'll come to Priva.
Okay, yeah? No problem. I don't have a problem. I support that. But I will just need to be clarified on what the...
I will deal with that because there is information that I must bring to the attention of the committee.
Right.
Can we get a proposal on the other two?
I propose that we approve whatever was the recommendation for the other one.
Any seconder? Honorable Hon, you second that. Okay. Those in favor of the removal from office of Stearman and Holler, can they take, can you take hands?
Why are you not voting?
Do you want to ask
them to do it? No. Those in favor? Can you say that we don't know the Wampungan or the Karimbi?
The Wampungan, you either fold your arms or raise another arm. How many?
One.
Yeah, five.
Okay.
But women agree.
Oh, it's not raising.
It's unanimous.
Wise men change their minds. Thank you. Honorable members, you can deal with that in your own party. For now, let's move on to the next. Honorable members, there was a matter relating to Mrs. Valerie Thabo Qhiba, and we had in principle approved her removal as the others, but in the meantime we received a notice of motion which was sent to us through the office of the committee secretary, but the legal advice says that the papers were not properly served on Parliament, and there are lawyers that acted on behalf of Mrs. Qhiba, so we cannot hold a client accountable for the negligence of their lawyers. So for our purposes, we can accept that there are indications that the affected person wants to take the matter further. So it would be fair that we keep this matter in abeyance and communicate with the complainants, with the lawyers, that they send us a document which is unprocedural, and then find out if they are going ahead with them, with the matter. But we cannot take a decision when there's something that is a process, although the process is defective. But let me hear from you. And that's why I want to deal with the matter separately. There's a notice of motion before us, but which was not properly served. But we cannot prejudice, in my view, prejudice the complainant because of the inaptitude of the lawyers. Honorable gentlemen,
I agree with you. I think I agree with you, Honorable Chair, on the very fact that there is indication to that matter. We are aware of it. We need to give it a chance. We are not really in a hurry to slaughter anybody. We need to be fair. And we are a committee of justice, and I think it is, if the matter is likely or is before court, we are barred from it actually taking a decision. I think what you are saying is acceptable and is correct. Let's put it away for some time.
Honorable Maile.
No, Chairperson, you see, if doing our work is tantamount to slaughtering people.
No, I withdraw that.
Let me withdraw that. I used the wrong word.
I withdraw. Yes,
I withdraw.
No. Honorable Chair, I think we must continue doing our work. Maybe because there's a seeming litigation before us. But I would suggest maybe that we seek legal opinion, either from Parliament or from the Executive. And that opinion will then give us the way to go. Yes.
Honorable Hon.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I agree in principle. The question I want an answer to is that although I see here in the application there is a prayer that this committee be, well, let's say interdicted from following up on our previous resolution to withhold remuneration and to suspend from office. But if there's no interdict in place, then I agree with the Honourable Mailo, we may also have a duty to continue doing our work. So maybe the proper course will be to get advice as to where we stand legally and what also our obligations are as the Committee of Parliament dealing with the matter, because just to fold hands and say we know there's some court action going and therefore we will put it on ice, it's not necessarily the proper way to deal with it.
I guess we're not putting anything on ice. Honorable Mutapo, you want to say something?
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. I would like to align myself with Honorable Maila and Ron and yourself. As soon as we get that legal advice, let's move on, please.
Yes.
As of now, our approval in principle
will stand. Yes.
And then as soon as we get that legal opinion, of which I already know what to do, then we move on.
Already know.
Honorable members, members of the committee have a duty to apply their minds to any issue before them, and you agree that we'll seek a legal opinion and then apply our minds to the issue, and then we will take a decision on that basis. And I thank you very much, honorable members. So the matter will be kept in abeyance and pending the legal opinion from the department. Thank you.
We are done for the day and we have done very well, and go there, go to the waterfront and enjoy yourself.
You don't have money.
You have told me earlier I would have made a plan.
Before you give, but before you want to come here, you don't see.